From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, Paul Zeitz is joining us to provide an update on the progress in the worldwide battle against the HIV epidemic during the year 2003. And later in the show, Maurice Savard and Susan Crosby will be with us to discuss a new effort to eliminate cervical cancer in the United States. They'll be discussing a new, more accurate form of screening for the disease and a new effort by female legislators across the country to draw attention to the prevention of cervical cancer. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In early December last year, the drug company Abbott Labs raised the price of ritonavir, a major HIV medicine, by 400%. The price increase raises the annual cost for ritonavir from $639 to over $3,100. A large percentage of HIV-infected patients consume many medications, often more than 10. The American Academy of HIV Medicine, the national organization of clinicians who care for HIV patients, has written a strongly worded protest against the repricing of ritonavir. The group characterized Abbott's action as contemptible. Abbott initially responded to the concerns about their repricing by noting that most HIV-infected patients receive subsidies, usually through state-administered programs, to support the cost of their medications. But many state governments have recently been cutting the programs targeted to HIV care due to these budget crises. Abbott then announced that they would continue to sell ritonavir to state government programs at the old price. On February 10th, a group of 400 doctors convened at a major annual conference on HIV medicine agreed that until Abbott reduces the price of ritonavir, they will resign from all Abbott advisory boards and lecture faculties and not participate in any future Abbott-sponsored clinical trials. In addition, the doctors stated that they will consider non-Abbott drug treatment alternatives for their patients when the two alternatives are equally safe. The group intends to publicize the boycott to other physicians to extend the boycott to Abbott's non-HIV drugs. The Attorney General's offices of New York and Illinois are exploring the possibility of legal action against Abbott. The Academy of HIV Medicine's policy statement is accessible at the group's website, aahivm.org. Abbott Labs' website is abbott.com. The Environmental Protection Agency announced late last year that it would not regulate dioxins in the agricultural use of sewage as a fertilizer. The EPA reached the conclusion, based on a hypothetical model of likely effects on the cancer experience of workers who work with dioxin-contaminated sewage. Dioxins are a family of chemicals that have been shown to cause both cancer and harm to the liver and hormone-producing organs in animals, and there is strong evidence to indicate that humans are susceptible to these same toxic effects. Although dioxins are found in small quantities in water and soil, they persist in the environment and accumulate in the food chain. The EPA decision has been widely criticized by environmental health advocates who argue that much more should be done to control the dissemination of dioxins in the environment, since the dioxins are among the most toxic artificial substances yet identified. The infant mortality rate in the United States rose for the first time in more than 40 years between 2001 and 2002, according to a report released in early February by the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics. Although the United States long has had one of the highest infant mortality rates among developed countries, the rate has either declined or remained steady every year since 1958. Data analysis determined that the 3% increase in the infant mortality rate was due to a rise in the number of deaths during the first week of life among low birth weight infants, infants born with birth defects, and infants born to women who had complications during pregnancy. No increase was seen in deaths during the remainder of the first year of life. The increase in deaths among infants in the first week of life may result from a rise in the number of births among older women and an increase in the number of women who use fertility treatments. Between 1980 and 1998, a rise in the use of fertility treatments led to a 400% increase in the number of multiple births in the United States, according to data released by the CDC in December of 2003. Infants who are born as a result of a multiple pregnancy are more likely to be born preterm, with low birth weights, and the mothers are more likely to experience complications during pregnancy. The report is available at the National Center for Health Statistics website, cdc.gov/NCHS, under State Tabulated Data. On a related issue, a Dutch study published in the January 31st issue of the British Medical Journal reported that infants who are the product of a single pregnancy and conceived through in vitro fertilization or other assisted reproductive technologies are more likely to be born premature, more likely to be delivered by C-section, and have lower than average birth weights compared with singleton infants conceived naturally. The researchers found that singleton infants born to women as a result of fertility treatments are twice as likely to be born preterm and three times more likely to weigh less than 1,500 grams compared with single infants conceived naturally. In addition, single infants conceived through fertility treatments were 68% more likely to be stillborn or die within the first week of life. Fertility treatments are known to increase the risks associated with multiple pregnancies, but this study is the first to show an increased risk of poor outcomes for single pregnancies conceived through fertility treatments. The researchers state that fertility research should not focus exclusively on achieving pregnancy, but should instead work toward the goal of improving birth outcomes. The report is available at the website of the British Medical Journal, bmj.com. An article in the January issue of the Journal of Pediatrics provides one of the most thorough studies of the consumption of fast food by children yet published. Using national survey data, which included over 6,000 families, the authors estimated that one out of every three children aged 4 through 19 eats fast food on any given day. This represents a fivefold increase in fast food consumption over the last three decades. Consumption of fast food was more common among teenagers, among children from families with higher household income, and was more common in the southeastern United States. Compared to kids who ate no fast food, kids who did eat fast food consumed more sugar and more fat, and overall ate 200 extra calories per day, which would add up to 6 pounds of weight per year. 15% of children and one-third of adults are clinically obese in the United States, numbers that have been progressively increasing over the last several decades. In a related issue, on January 20th, the World Health Organization convened a special meeting to launch an initiative to combat the worldwide epidemic of obesity. The initiative calls for food and beverage companies to reduce fat and sugar content of their products and to restrict food advertising aimed at children. Reporting on this meeting of the WHO, the Wall Street Journal reported that the delegation from the United States opposed many of the key provisions in the World Health Organization's initiative. In a letter to the World Health Organization leadership, the U.S. delegation indicated that there is no scientific data that link food advertising on children's TV to obesity. The letter also questioned the benefit of fruit and vegetable consumption in preventing obesity and diabetes, even though replacing sugars and fats with natural fruits and vegetables is recommended by the American Diabetes Association and is a standard recommendation that nearly every doctor gives to patients who are attempting to lose weight. The World Health Organization report also recommends that patients try to achieve an hour of moderate exercise daily when possible. The U.S. delegation also questioned that recommendation. Industry groups, especially the American and European processed food lobbies and sugar growers, have vehemently opposed many aspects of the report. And a small number of countries have supported the U.S. position, including Cuba and the Philippines, both heavily dependent on sugar exports. Obesity rates have been increasing dramatically worldwide as more people are exercising less and consuming more junk food and sweetened beverages. More than 1 billion people worldwide are overweight, and one-third of these are clinically obese, according to World Health Organization data. A description of the initiative is available at the World Health Organization's website, who.int, in the Notes for the Press section. Coming up, a report on recent progress in combating the HIV epidemic. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In his State of the Union message in January of 2003, President Bush highlighted the significance of the HIV epidemic worldwide and signaled the intent of the U.S. to respond with a $10 billion program over a five-year period. But shortly thereafter, conflict in Iraq and the Middle East took over the headlines, and the major international public health stories of the year were the SARS epidemic, which took a total of 7,000 lives, and mad cow disease, which killed a handful of people. Neither of these turned out to be nearly comparable in scale to the HIV crisis. Nonetheless, HIV rarely penetrated any of the major media outlets. But a number of developments did take place in the effort to confront the HIV crisis during this last year. To update us on developments in the HIV epidemic, Paul Zeitz has joined us. Dr. Zeitz has combined training in medicine and public health and consistently used that training to battle the HIV epidemic. He spent 10 years in Africa working on the issue with the World Health Organization, with UNICEF, and with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He is co-founder and executive director of the Global AIDS Alliance, an international coalition of private sector groups which are working to combat the HIV crisis. Paul Zeitz, welcome back to Public Health Radio.
Thanks, Marvin.
Perhaps more than any other year over the last five or six at least, the HIV crisis has just not pierced the major news media. One would almost think that the whole problem's just gone. I'd like to give you a moment to remind listeners about the scale of the crisis and maybe comparing it to other public health problems.
Well, the UNAIDS put out an estimate of the AIDS epidemic on December 1st, 2003, which showed the biggest increase in new cases and the largest number of annual deaths since the pandemic first was monitored about 20 years ago. This year, UNAIDS estimated that 3 million people died of AIDS, 2.3 million of those in sub-Saharan Africa, and there were about 5 million new infections, the bulk of those also in sub-Saharan Africa. But starkly, we learned that the epidemic is spreading rapidly in parts of Asia, especially India and China, and also countries that are part of the former Soviet Union, including Russia, the Ukraine, and other Eastern European countries.
Why did that information only come out this year?
people who are involved in the response have known about the crisis. I think it became more publicly aware that this epidemic is right now epicentered in sub-Saharan Africa, but it's pretty well documented now that it's going to be shifting into Asia. And the kind of epidemic that we're seeing in southern and eastern Africa now, Asia is at risk of having those kinds of pandemics. Right now, the national prevalence in India is about 5% of adults have HIV infection. There are some states that have much higher levels, which means that it's starting to go from high-risk subgroups of the population, like truckers and sex workers, and now it is becoming generalized in the general population in some states in India. Well, India has 1 billion people. If you get an epidemic with 5 or 10% prevalence going on, it's a lot more people there than in all of Africa. So that's why the epidemic is so serious in that part of the world.
Now, the one area of relative optimism in what seems to be a pretty overwhelming picture is in the response to the epidemic. And from what I've read in the last year, it sounds like the efforts to combat the epidemic where they exist have been more effective, and there seem to be fewer obstacles. Is that the case?
I think that 2003 was a turning point where we saw the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria have its first full year of operations, and they provided grants to nearly 100 countries to scale up programs for AIDS prevention and treatment. We also saw the political will shift from the wealthy nations when President Bush made his announcement that he was going to launch a quote-unquote emergency plan to stop AIDS. That was the highest level political will from a wealthy nation that we've seen that has sparked, you know, further actions from other countries like Britain and Germany. So we're seeing a shift in political will, so more money is being mobilized to actually deliver the programs that we know work.
Well, that answers the question from the point of view of potential donor countries. But I'd also like to look at the same question from the vantage point of the HIV-impacted areas themselves. Out in the towns and villages where HIV-infected patients actually live, are we finding that treatment programs have been demonstrating greater effectiveness?
I think that there's been more awareness raised about treatment programs with life-saving AIDS medications being effective and replicable. We have programs now in sub-Saharan Africa where relatively poor people have been treated with complicated AIDS medications in both rural and urban areas through the public and through the private sector. And we now know that the African people can be compliant with these regimens and that they can have the same benefit in terms of transforming the disease from a death sentence into a chronic illness. So I think there was new evidence of that during 2003 for sure.
Has that translated into a substantially greater proportion of HIV-infected individuals, for example, in Africa, actually being treated? I recently read that it's still well under 5% of HIV-infected individuals have ever been treated. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it's still true that only a small percentage of those that are medically eligible for antiretroviral therapy are actually receiving them. Most people in the northern hemisphere who are eligible do have access to these drugs. In sub-Saharan Africa, it's less than 1% that are currently receiving them. But I believe in 2004, we're going to see a dramatic change. The Global Fund programs are going to be up and running, number one. Number two, the President's initiative targets treatment in 12 sub-Saharan African countries and 2 Caribbean countries, and those programs are going to start being rolled out early in this year. Plus, we are seeing increased efforts from the private sector, like the Clinton Foundation, for example, has a 4-country initiative that's designed to scale treatment nationally in 4 African countries. So there's a lot of new efforts that will start to hit the ground during 2004. So hopefully next year at this time, we'll have a different picture to report.
And what's the current state of the effort of HIV activists to obtain antiretroviral medicine at costs that are affordable to these poor countries?
Well, the current state is that we're still, there's several things that have happened. One is that there were several victories during 2003. We were successful in encouraging the U.S. government to support the Doha Declaration, which declared that countries with public health emergencies for AIDS, TB, and malaria could issue compulsory licenses for which would allow them to purchase generically manufactured drugs at best world prices. So that was a significant development. And unfortunately, the U.S. government is now using bilateral trade agreements to reverse the progress made at Doha. They're now negotiating the Central American Free Trade Agreement. There's a Southern African Free Trade Agreement. And these agreements are what's called TRIPS Plus, which means that they're reversing the concessions made at Doha, and they're requiring countries, or they're limiting countries' ability to declare a public health emergency and do parallel importing of generic drugs. So the key question really is, do we have, you know, are we purchasing large amounts of drugs at best world prices that are high quality? And I think we haven't broken through completely on that yet. Hopefully, during 2004, we'll see more progress. There has been some progress, but not enough yet.
Why did the U.S. change its position?
Well, it's not that they changed their position. There was a concession made at the WTO level, but they still pursue the original agenda through bilateral trade agreements. So they concede when they have to.
The original agenda was not to allow generic drugs.
Not to allow developing countries to issue compulsory licenses, so that they could import or produce generically manufactured drugs. And they conceded because there was a lot of pressure at Doha and through the WTO. The concessions that they made were more substantive from a public relations standpoint. When you look at the actual provisions that they required to be included, there's a lot of questions about whether it could even be implemented through the WTO. But the true reading of what their intentions are becomes clear when you watch their actions with the bilateral trade agreements, where they're overtly reversing a progress made at Doha and going back to a TRIPS Plus formula, which means that countries won't have the ability to declare a public health emergency to do parallel importing of generics.
After President Clinton completed his term in office, he established a foundation called the Clinton Foundation. And I know that foundation has also been active in the issue of affordability of HIV treatment. Tell us about that.
The big development is the Clinton Initiative model, where they came up with a model and they have commitments from generic manufacturers to produce generic drugs at 58 cents per day, which is much less than the currently available generic drugs, which are about $1 a day, from India. So the Clinton Initiative set up a framework to drop the prices almost in half, and that's set the standard. You know, that's the new gold standard for purchasing of drugs. And the other big development was that WHO announced a new global initiative called 3x5, which is aiming to get 3 million people on treatment by 2005. That's approximately 50% of the medically eligible people. So we're going from what we say are, say, 5% of medically eligible people on treatment now, and the goal by WHO is to get 50% of medically eligible people on treatment by the end of 2005.
WHO is the World Health Organization, right?
Yeah, the World Health Organization Initiative. So that is a quite ambitious effort, but they are they're issuing new guidelines for drug purchasing. They're supporting the development of capsules that have all three drugs in one tablet, so that a person in a resource-poor country would only have to take a tablet once in the morning and once at night, and it would be three drugs in each tablet. That will increase compliance and reduce the development of to resistance to these drugs. So that's a big development. They're going to be training hundreds of thousands of workers to be able to provide treatment. So it's a quite significant development that WHO has stepped up to the plate, and they're using their leadership to really galvanize a full treatment initiative globally.
Recently, James Baker undertook a voyage across the globe, attempting to persuade wealthy nations to forgive the debts owed to their countries by Iraq. The logic was that the debt would represent a drain on resources and prevent development in Iraq, and the trip was got a lot of publicity and was fairly successful. And I guess the question I have, there's a great deal of international debt owed by many of the nations most heavily impacted by HIV, and I have to believe that that debt is hindering their response to the HIV epidemic. But as far as I know, no representative of our government has ever gone across the globe to advocate for forgiveness of debt anywhere else other than Iraq. Do you think that this precedent will be favorable and maybe make the U.S. government more willing to look at the international debt burden by many of these countries face?
Well, it's hard for me to know what is possible. I think what I can tell you is that on May 28th, when President Bush signed historic global AIDS legislation, built into that legislation were provisions that said any country that is currently experiencing an HIV/AIDS pandemic or is at risk of developing an AIDS pandemic should be eligible for accelerated debt cancellation under the HIPC initiative, the heavily indebted poor country initiative of the IMF and the World Bank. Now, the White House has taken no action to implement those provisions. In fact, the Department of Treasury is not really supportive of accelerating debt cancellation for these African countries. I agree with your comment that it's hard to imagine really a successful effort against AIDS until we deal with the debt crisis. The 14 countries, for example, that are prioritized by President Bush in his emergency plan are paying out $10 billion per year in annual debt servicing payments to the creditors. These are odious debts that were basically used for Cold War politics or other kinds of political purposes. And the countries are new democracies, yet they're being forced to pay back this this debt. Now, the Bush initiative is only putting in new $10 billion of new money over 5 years. So during that same five-year period, $50 billion is flowing out of these countries to the northern financial institutions. So I agree that we have to continue advocating for full debt cancellation or accelerating debt cancellation for these countries if we're ever to hope to combat the poverty and the AIDS crisis that is persistent.
Well, Paul Zeitz, I'd like to thank you for joining us again on Public Health Radio.
Thanks, Marvin.
And I hope to hear from you sometime in the next year again.
I hope so.
Coming up next, we'll discuss a new effort to eliminate cervical cancer in the United States. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. A great deal of attention has been focused on ovarian cancer, and especially breast cancer, over the last 15 years. But despite the fact that it is the most easily prevented of all forms of cancer in both sexes, far less attention has been paid to cancer of the cervix, which takes the lives of 4,000 women each year in the U.S. Recently, the American Cancer Society has made an important change in its recommendation for cervical cancer screening. One feature of that change is to include testing for the HPV virus as part of the process of screening for cervical cancer. Women in Government, the national organization that represents female legislators in the U.S., has just last month begun a major initiative to mobilize the efforts of state and federal government to eliminate cervical cancer. Joining us today to discuss the prevention of cervical cancer are Maurice Savard and Susan Crosby. Maurice Savard is a physician specializing in women's health and serves as director of the Center for Women's Health at the Medical College of Pennsylvania, where she is a faculty member. She is currently the chair of the Pennsylvania Commission on Women. Susan Crosby served in the legislature of the state of Indiana for 12 years and is currently the deputy executive director of Women in Government. Maurice Savard and Susan Crosby, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Good morning, Marvin. We're pleased to be with you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Why don't we start out by talking about the magnitude of the problem of cervical cancer, both worldwide as well as in the United States?
Sure. Worldwide, cervical cancer affects 500,000 women every year. And of those women, 50%, half of them will die from the disease. In the United States, it's because we have had better screening, only 12,000 women will be diagnosed with cervical cancer. But even still, almost 30% of those women will die, and that's 30% too many. No one, it's 100% preventable. No one should be diagnosed or die with that disease.
The notion that a form of cancer could be 100% preventable makes cervical cancer somewhat unique. We still don't do nearly that well in terms of other cancers we try to prevent. If that's the case, why do you feel we still see so many cases of cervical cancer in the U.S.?
Well, there's two reasons. First, many women, too many women, are not being screened at all. But the other reason is because the screening that we do have is not as accurate as it could be, as we now have better testing for. And so women who've been screened have not had the chance to be diagnosed as well.
I'd like to talk a little bit maybe at this point about what you could think of as screening failures. When women go to their doctor to get a pap smear, I don't think they're thinking, boy, the screening method might not work. So I guess I'd like to talk to you about how effective current screening methods are.
Sure. It is known that the pap test, if you have abnormal cells, will only detect those abnormal cells 50 to 85% of the time. So you could have up to a 50-50 chance of that pap test not finding those abnormal cells. Because of that, we suggest to women that they get the test in the past year after year after year. So if you miss it 1 year, you're going to find those abnormal cells the next year. Cervical cancer is unique in that we know the cause. It's the HPV virus. And number two, we know how to screen and detect that virus early on. And we know that there's a long phase interval between getting that virus and then having changes in the cells occur. So there's many years that doctors have to pick up on the pap test the cell changes and give the patient the treatment that's necessary. But again, the pap test isn't 100%. Sometimes it's no better than 50% in picking up the abnormal cell changes.
Well, why don't we focus right now on the HPV virus? What is that virus, and what is its natural history if it's not treated?
HPV stands for human papillomavirus, and many women, as I speak across the country, ask me, what is that virus? It's amazing how few women understand the role of that virus and the cause of cervical cancer. HPV is typically thought of as the wart virus, so there are up to 100 different strains. Some of them cause the common skin wart that many women and obviously many of us have been aware of. But on the other hand, there are a number of high-risk strains of the virus that cause no symptoms at all and that can affect women, the cervix and vagina tissue. So that it's that virus that causes cervical cancer if remains persistent. The truth is, most of us have been exposed to the HPV virus at one point or a time or another. They say up to 70% of adults.
And it's sexually transmitted, is that the...
Yes, it's sexually transmitted. That's how we get the cells, the virus, in the cells of on our cervix. And it's estimated that around 70% of people have been exposed to that virus at one time or another. It doesn't cause symptoms. And the good news is most of us will, within a year or two, clear the virus. Our own immune system will get rid of that virus. But for a small number of women, the virus can persist. And especially as we get older, and women over the age of 30, if you have evidence of the virus persisting, meaning your special test for the HPV shows the virus staying year after year, it's that group of women that have the high risk of developing cervical cancer. And those women need the more careful screening, more close monitoring. The rest of us, people who are test HPV negative after age 30, can relax and undergo both the Pap and HPV together on an every 3-year interval because, again, you can be highly reassured. It's virtually 100%, what we call 100% negative predictive value. If your test for HPV is negative, if your Pap test is negative, you can be assured virtually 100% that you do not have cervical cancer. We could never give that kind of peace of mind and assurance with a Pap test alone.
Can you describe the test for HPV? Is it uncomfortable to receive the test?
Sure. It's like getting your Pap test. In fact, it's so important and so easy that women have to talk to their doctor about it because they won't know if they don't ask whether they're even getting that test. What the doctor does when they do the Pap smear, they'll use a brush in addition to somewhat of a sort of a wooden spatula, but they'll use a brush to go in and scrape the lining cervical cells inside the canal. And that same brush or a different brush is used to, again, take more cells and put into a solution. So you're simply using a brush to collect the cells inside the cervix, and it's those cells that are used both to smear on a slide to look under the microscope. That's the traditional Pap test. And those same cells, again, are used in the solution to detect the HPV high-risk strain viruses.
So from the woman's point of view, it would feel exactly like a Pap smear.
Absolutely.
Marvin, I might interject here. I had just finished having mine, and just as I had finished having my exam, I happened to remember, oh, I want to go ahead and have the test for HPV. And I told her, and she says, oh, I've already done it. So, you know, you virtually don't know that you've had it done. It's not really any different at all from the regular Pap smear.
Right. That's a good point, Susan, and it's a good point to remind women to ask their doctor whether or not they are screening with the HPV test.
At this point, maybe it would make sense to talk about what the new guidelines are that make use of this test. I guess the National Organization of OBGYN Physicians, as well as the American Cancer Society, have changed their longstanding recommendation about cervical cancer screening to include this test. So what is it they're recommending now?
Well, first of all, the important thing is they've changed the recommendations because the science is better. We now understand the cause, the HPV virus, and we now have a way to diagnose the HPV virus, the HPV or DNA test. So because of that, they've changed the guidelines to reflect, number one, women don't need to start getting a Pap test as early as we used to. We used to say 18. The truth is young women can start at age 21 or about 3 years after they've begun having sex because we know that it takes at least 3 years, if not more, to develop cell changes if you've been exposed to the high-risk virus. So that's number one. The second important change is that both societies are now recommending that women over 30 be tested together with the Pap test and the HPV virus test because the combination of the two tests, as I've mentioned before, will reassure a woman if she's negative. And 95% of women over 30 are going to be negative for both. Women can be reassured that they are at virtually no risk of developing cervical cancer. And those women who test negative, they do not need to be screened more than every 3 years. What's the big secret out there is there's so many women, I talk to them all across the country, who've had abnormal Pap tests and are subject to, you know, they're afraid, they're nervous, they come back for repeat testing, they lose time from work, and they end up getting colposcopy or even biopsies or the freezing procedure. When, in fact, probably half those women with the mildly abnormal Pap test, if they had undergone the HPV test, could have been reassured if it was negative that they can safely continue to just be checked every year if they're a young woman or up to every 3 years in women over 30. And the 30-year cutoff is important because that's when we know that the HPV virus, if it's positive, may be a persistent virus. It may be that you're someone who carries that virus and your immune system hasn't gotten rid of it. Young women, if you tested them with the HPV, 25% of young women at any one period of time might have some high-risk strains of the virus because it's extremely common. And again, we quickly fight off the virus. Our immune system works to get rid of it.
What's the recommendation for women between the ages of 21 and 30?
The recommendations from the American Cancer Society are that if you've had 3 negative Pap tests in a row, you could safely change the screening from every year to every 2 years. The American College of OBGYN doctors, they feel strongly that young women should continue to be screened every year because certainly those women are exposed to a number of sexually transmitted diseases. They really need to be contacting their doctor for general checkups anyway. So I think overall, pretty much the medical community accepts continuing to screen and examine young women and counsel young women about the importance of their health and things that they can do on a yearly basis.
Is it known if use of condoms can prevent the transmission of HPV?
Condoms can't. Obviously, it provides some protection, some barrier protection, but it's skin-to-skin contact that leads to the virus. The virus lives on the skin, and obviously, the condom does not provide a complete barrier from skin to skin. So it may help somewhat, but it's certainly by no means considered reassurance. On the other hand, if a woman tests positive for HPV, because it is such a common prevalent virus, she doesn't need to take any special precautions. It's universal. We all, men and women, have been exposed to the virus, and our own immune system takes care of it. So it's just the women whose immune system hasn't cleared the virus, that is the women who have the positive HPV test that persists, that really are at risk for cell changes and cervical cancer.
I'd like now to talk about the administrative aspects of this new test procedure, the HPV test. Is the HPV test costly, say, compared to a pap smear or other tests like a mammogram?
Well, the great news is that many insurance companies, in fact, most, already reimburse for the HPV testing for routine screening, and certainly they already reimburse for women who get the HPV test if they have an abnormal pap test. That we've been doing for the past 2 years. So that's the good, you know, number one, the good news. As far as studies of showing the cost effectiveness, using both the HPV and pap together in the long run will actually save money because it's going to reduce the unnecessary follow-up colposcopies and coming back in 6 to 12 months, testing, whatever. So cost savings overall will be significant.
Well, let's take a short break. We've been speaking with Susan Crosby and Dr. Maurice Savard about screening for cervical cancer and the new recommendation to include HPV viral testing as part of the screening process. After the break, we'll be learning about the initiative of women legislators across the country to draw attention to the new test and to attempt to decrease the incidence of cervical cancer and preferably eliminate it altogether. We'll also talk about some of the obstacles in the way of accomplishing this. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. We've been discussing the prevention of cervical cancer with Maurice Savard, a doctor and expert in women's health, and Susan Crosby, who is a leader of Women in Government, the organization that represents female legislators across the country. Back to the interview.
Now, Susan Crosby, you've been relatively quiet, and I'd like to turn to you a little bit now.
Sure.
You're part of an organization called Women in Government.
Yes.
And I guess I know that that organization has taken on the issue of the prevention of cervical cancer as a major initiative. And I guess I'd like to give you a chance to talk about who is in Women in Government and
right.
How you decided on the cervical cancer issue.
Thank you, Margaret. Women in Government is a national organization of women legislators across this nation. And this is a bipartisan group. We have about equal number of Democrats as well as Republicans, as well as members in the House and the Senate. And last month, we launched our Challenge to Eliminate Cervical Cancer campaign, which is basically designed to help reduce the number of women who die each year of this very preventable disease. Through our campaign, we're challenging state legislators to pass our members' bills and resolutions calling for improved public education about cervical cancer and HPV, as well as broadening access to the most advanced screening tests, regardless of women's socioeconomic status. You know, as Dr. Marie said earlier, approximately half of all cervical cancers are in women who have never been screened. And to us, this is just, you know, such a tragedy, and that women need to be educated about having screening, as well as we need to make sure they have access to this very important screening technique.
So what specific policies are you recommending that state and potentially federal legislators should do? What exactly do you want them to do?
Well, we believe that the best approach is for each state to determine what works best for them. We're not advocating a cookie-cutter approach. Basically, using the most up-to-date information and practices, for instance, several states either have established or are establishing task force in their state to review basically the cervical cancer situation and then determine how screening can be improved and advanced testing can be incorporated into screening programs. For example, down in North Carolina, legislation has passed that calls for a task force as well as coverage for screening programs that follow the current American Cancer Society. We just, as I said earlier, launched this campaign last month, and we already have 17 states that have either introduced resolutions or legislation. So we're really excited that this is gaining national momentum, and we believe since this is probably one of the first cancers that we can truly eliminate, that we as women really need to get behind this effort.
Now, many state governments are in dire financial straits. Do you worry that that may be an obstacle to implementing a new health initiative?
Well, you know, basically, if improved screening using the best tests available can save a woman's life and can help reduce costs associated with treating cervical cancer, you know, I just can't think of states not being able to afford to move forward on this.
At the beginning of the this recording, Dr. Savard mentioned that large numbers of women are not being screened at all, and there could be a variety of reasons for that. But certainly one possibility, and I know this has proven to be important for early pregnancy care, one possibility is that women don't go to the doctor because they have no health insurance. So I'd like both of you to tell me what your feelings are about access to care for women in the both under and over age 30 who do not have health insurance. What kinds of things can and should be done in that population of women to prevent cervical cancer?
I can speak from the position. I'm chair of the Pennsylvania Commission on Women, and we're working with a coalition in Pennsylvania to actually, currently we have in our budget a small amount of money, $1 million, to actually help get women screened across the state with with the techniques that are available for cervical cancer. So I think state by state, they have to make sure that there is a loud, vocal group of women, and we are trying to get that coalition of women together in Pennsylvania to speak on behalf of the voiceless, these women who don't have insurance, don't have access, don't have the education, and see that there are clinics. Planned Parenthood, I know, has done a tremendous job of getting the resources together to provide this type of screening to women who are underinsured or uninsured altogether.
Yes, and then from my perspective, Marvin, I know that across this nation, we have various women's commissions as well as offices of women's health who are also organizing and trying to galvanize women to, again, be very present in public policy debates and discussions to make sure that when insurance coverage is talked about, whether it is for third-party payees to Medicaid, that women will have coverage for this very preventable disease.
You know, unfortunately, more women are going off the ranks of Medicaid, not being eligible for Medicaid, and yet falling into this uninsured or underinsured bracket that you're referring to, which I feel is an opportunity and an obligation for all of us as women to see that our sisters are screened, because it's just unacceptable that any woman should be diagnosed with cervical cancer at any age. And young women, yes, they need to be screened as well. And we need to see that the resources are available in our communities.
Now, there was an initiative in New York State to provide screening for breast cancer and cervical cancer in women who do not have health insurance. And there's a similar program in Vermont, again, for both breast and cervical cancer, the more preventable cancers. Mm-hmm. But then if they actually were diagnosed with the disease, that coverage wasn't there. It only was there to screen them. In other words, they could have the disease detected, but then if the screening test was positive and showed there was a problem, they no longer had any coverage. They returned to basically being uninsured, as they would be for everything else. What do you think that that's an inherent problem with coming up with these types of categorical programs that only cover screening but not treatment?
No, absolutely not. My response to that is we have an obligation to provide the necessary screening for women. And furthermore, if I can understand the challenge, but if a woman is diagnosed with cervical cancer as a result of these screening programs, that these screening programs have the obligation to help that woman. I think to just hide our heads in the sand and not do anything about it is worse. So I think we have a chance to not only screen, which will help all women, and then for the few women who as a result are diagnosed with cervical cancer, we can then use our resources more wisely. We can't go back to the dark ages. We have the science. We have the treatment available. It's unacceptable that we don't move forward to eliminate cervical cancer.
Susan Crosby, before we began recording, you mentioned your experience attempting to introduce legislation to provide complete cancer treatment for all women in your state who were diagnosed with cervical or breast cancer while insured through the state's Medicaid program. This was when you were a representative in the Indiana legislature?
In my sophomore year as a legislator, I was still doing things I didn't realize I couldn't do. And one of them was that I put in legislation for women who were on Medicaid, not only to have the ability to have the screening for breast cancer, but then also the follow-up treatment. I thought nothing was more tragic than for us to tell a woman that she had cancer, but hey, we were not going to provide treatment for you. So I put that through, and my members of the House, because I was in the majority party, passed it, and it went over to the Senate, and they said, basically, Susan, it's dead, because the Senate never does legislation that's gender-specific. Well, it went over to the Senate, and a leading member from the Senate came back over and talked to me and said, you know, we usually don't pass gender-specific legislation over here, and I see that this is strictly for women for breast cancer. Would you have any problems if I would put in it that it would also cover men who have prostate cancer having follow-up? And I said, heavens no, I don't have any problems with that. And with that, we got it passed, you know. And it's such a simple thing to do, but people just oftentimes don't think of compromises along those ways when they are working on legislation. And that's how we got the coverage for women in Indiana to not only have detection for breast cancer who are on Medicaid, but also treatment.
Well, actually, I'd like to comment on that, and I'd love to hear what Dr. Savard would say. It sounds like it's very simple that a woman is screened for cervical or breast cancer, or a man for prostate cancer. You discover the cancer, so it seems completely unethical that you would then say, goodbye, we're not going to treat you. Everyone realizes how expensive cancer treatment can become, and it's often a protracted effort over many months and years. But I don't think it's so easy to isolate. The cancer treatment may affect the other problems they have, like diabetes. And what do you think about this, Dr. Savard? How do you bill for the implications of all that the chemotherapy might be doing, or what radiation therapy might affect? What do you think about that?
Right. Well, God, I think it's absolutely unthinkable to not treat someone once you've made a diagnosis of a horrible disease, whether it's prostate cancer, cervical cancer, whatever. And I think, as you said, the implications of that treatment, I mean, we don't live in isolation. Every aspect of our health is kind of related. And we, as a society, people that fall through the cracks end up getting into the emergency rooms and treated at sort of very advanced stages when they're extremely sick.
Do you think it might be simpler to have a healthcare system that included everybody and provided insurance for everyone?
Yeah. I think the obvious is a single payer would make this idea of carving out. To me, it's beyond thinking, you know, to imagine carving out diseases and entities. Well, we shouldn't define women's health in terms of reproductive health. I mean, women, a healthy woman affects children, it affects her partner, it affects society at large. So to us, for us to compromise a woman's health, and a woman's health might mean treating her for her depression or stress. I mean, that might get her in the door for the cervical cancer screening. It's all related. So, yeah, I mean, I think it all boils down to if we, as a society, sort of looked at health and made an effort to see that everyone received the appropriate and necessary care.
At this point, I'd like to ask you if you could direct interested listeners to take actions that you think might help encourage their governmental officials to get involved. What would you like them to do? And also maybe provide listeners some websites where they might learn more about the issue.
Well, of course, you know, with Women in Government, we have a website spelled out all in one long word, womenandgovernmentnoabbreviations.org. And through that, they will be able to find out more information about our challenge to eliminate cervical cancer. And then with American Cancer Society, they have a great website, too, which is cancer.org. And then CDC, the Center for Disease Control, also has an excellent page on public health screening programs. And if women want to access that through CDC.gov, they can, too.
There's a website called www.puttingwomenshealthfirst.com. Which will give women a lot of information. I think the more information women have, the more power they are, and to be armed to sort of help their own themselves, help their communities, and to work in a better partnership with their doctors, because this is a new era. We now have to move forward and move women's health into a sort of a smarter, you know, way to practice. And I think women will make it happen. They did it with breast cancer. They're going to do it with cervical cancer. We just raise awareness, and suddenly you have a groundswell of activity. And it's an issue that every one of us has to care about.
Well, Dr. Savard and Susan Crosby, I'd like to thank you both for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having us.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio. We'll be right back.